Welcome to Barry Maguire's Tales from the Trenches, real life stories of Canadian real estate investors. Learn more at www.barrymaguire.ca.
Alberta Real Estate Association, that's AREA. Alberta Real Estate Association governs the realtors and the way real estate works in the province. About 25 years ago, AREA spent $250,000 on the best real estate lawyer they could find. It wasn't me, it was a different guy. I mean, it's a bad choice. But anyway, they spent $250,000 and they revamped the old one-page, looked like it was written on a piece of toilet paper contract, into a much better contract. And they've been doing revisions over the years as stuff comes up. So the last time they did a big change was February of 2014. And then in about October or November of last year, we heard about the brand new changes. If you look at the contract at the bottom in the right-hand corner, it says September 2016. Whole bunch of background or material from AREA that I got, and I read it all over. And then it took me 4 months to review it all and look at all the changes. And just as I was polishing it off, but after I'd sent my presentation to print, I looked at a new contract, and I'm expecting it to say September 2016, and it said July 2017 on the bottom right. And I went, what the? Anyway, tweaks. This new contract was out. They worked with it for a while, so there's tweaks. So what we're doing is going to cover the most up-to-date changes in the current real estate purchase contract, which is the contract that most of you will use if you're buying and selling property here in Alberta. That's the one your realtor will use, so you should be familiar with it. All right, well, let's talk about the first one. Well, the old contract said that if there were tenants, the buyer and seller should talk about whether or not the buyer wanted to take over the tenants. Kind of wishy-washy. Now it says that the seller's obligation under the contract is to give the buyer vacant possession. His job is to give you a house with nobody in it. That's what it says. Now, if it has a fabulous tenant in there that you want to keep, then you negotiate with the seller and you go, well, that's okay. You don't have to do that. And then you go into the formalities of taking over the tenant. But right now, he's got to give you vacant possession. That's his obligation. Okay, so that's nice. I think everybody thought they were crisping up the procedure and they were going to make sure that if there was a tenant in there that you didn't want to take over, that the seller would get rid of that tenant. But guess what? In the last month, I've had three deals where buyers did not want to take over tenants, thought that the seller had given notice and that the tenant would be gone. And on closing, the tenant is still going to be there. So, you know, they made a change to the contract. It ends up being, so what? If the tenant is supposed to move and he doesn't, what are you going to do? So what can you do about this? What can buyers do where the seller says, I'm going to get rid of that tenant, and that's what you're relying on because you want to do renovations, get in there and get going. Both of my clients have got tradesmen booked and supplies coming, and now they're not going to be able to get possession. They're just screwing up their schedule like crazy. So here's a couple things that you can do if you really want possession. You say to the seller, fabulous, you've given notice to your tenant, official notice. I want a copy of that official notice you've given to your tenant. Because in a couple of cases, sellers gave the wrong notice. They gave, like, instead of giving the appropriate 3 months, 90 days notice, they gave a 60-day notice. So it wasn't an effective notice. So you can ask for a copy of the notice. And I say you should get over there, or your realtor should get over to the property, you know, a week before closing. Talk to the tenant. How's it going? Looks like you're moving. Yeah, getting packed up. Sure you're going to clean up all this stuff. That would be really nice if it was nice and clean. Everything going good? You need to get a sense of whether or not that tenant is moving or not. Sometimes they're not. So, nice change to the contract, but it's not as effective as we would want it to be. The old contract had on the first page all the numbers. Deposit, second deposit, mortgage that the buyer was getting, other value, seller financing, balance of cash on closing, full purchase price. All of that's gone now. All there is really is deposits and purchase price. The rest of it is out. And the thinking there is, it looks kind of weird. You know, you have all those columns, you're supposed to put stuff in. It looks kind of weird. There's just like a deposit and a purchase price. So that's a change that you need to get used to. I think the thinking is, if the buyer's buying, it's up to him to come up with his money. If he's going to go unconditional on the deal, he's got to get a mortgage. He's got to figure out those things. What do I care as a seller? I think that's why they did that. A new clause, 2.4, says that the property has to be in the same condition as it was on the day of acceptance. The change is completion day versus possession day. Completion day is the day that the money changes hands between the lawyers. Possession day is the day that the buyer gets a key. And those can, they're always, almost always the same day, but they can be a different day. Buyer might negotiate possession 2 days before or 2 days after, depending. So completion day is the day the money changes hands. But business days now include all hours of the day, and that all goods have to be in normal working order. And this is also an official representation and warranty. Clause 6 of the contract has all the things that the seller is promising. This is another promise from the seller to the buyer. And we want it to be a representation and warranty because you want it to survive the closing, and that's what representations and warranties do. You get in there on closing day, you look at the big new double door stainless steel $3,000 fridge freezer unit, and you open it up and it isn't working and it won't work. It's supposed to be in normal working condition on closing day. You're not going to get any money on closing day. You can't stop the transaction. But you want to be able to, after the fact, go back to the seller and go, hey, wasn't working. You got to fix it. So watch out for that. Watch out for that when you're a buyer. Holdbacks are a very useful tool in circumstances where there's four old cars in the backyard and the seller says he's going to get rid of them. You'd like to negotiate a holdback that says seller will get rid of cars and they'll be gone 2 days before closing, or buyer gets $1,000 credit or holdback. But for the things to be in good working order, that's a tougher one. Because you go to the house, you do an inspection, you check and see that it's all in working order. And if it's all fine, then it's difficult to negotiate one that says, okay, I need a holdback of some amount for some indeterminable thing that might go wrong. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like ones where people want to hold back. They want to do that last inspection before they turn over the money. But unless you know there's a problem that you can point to and put a dollar figure on, it's really hard to negotiate. Material latent defects. In the old contract, it just talked about defects. Sellers have to disclose defects in the property. So if the seller knows about something that's wrong with the property that the buyer can't really see, latent means the you can't see it on a reasonable inspection, then the seller has to disclose. So it used to be called just a defect. Now it's kind of tightened up to be a material latent defect. Material meaning more serious. And the old contract talked about latent defects that made the property dangerous. And they used another word that was like dangerous. I can't remember what it was. You see, they've ratcheted back the volume of those words. Defects that will affect the use or value of the property, not defects that make the property dangerous. So it's got to be a material latent defect, and it's got to be something that will affect the use or value of the property. That is to get by sellers who say, well, I didn't think that concealed hole in the floor that was covered by the rug that somebody might step into, I didn't think that was dangerous. I know about it. Anybody would know about it. You can just see it on the edge there. So there were things going on about what was dangerous and what wasn't dangerous. This is a bit more definable. Something that will affect the use and value of the property is more of an objective view of what's wrong with the property. Dangerous is kind of in the eye of the person defining it. So that's a change. Watch out for that. Have to watch as sellers. This is a brand new section at the beginning of the contract. It talks about what the seller will do in terms of being able to give those representations and warranties in Clause 6. So Clause 6 is the big representations and warranties clause. This says the seller is going to actually look at his real property report. He's going to look at his title. He's going to look at his real property report and go, oh, there's no compliance on this. Or look, my garage is over on the neighbor's yard. Ah, who would have thought? I forgot about that. Or that Would you look at that title? I know that I've got a mortgage with BMO. Oh yeah, TD and Royal Bank. I forgot to get those ones discharged. Huh, interesting. Guess my lawyer will take care of that. And non-resident status, dower rights. So all of those things are seller warranty things. And I think what this is it's poking this in the face of the seller to say, listen, Mr. Seller, you're giving a bunch of reps and warranties to the buyer. You're telling him a whole bunch of stuff that's true. And you actually have to do something so that you can make those and say whether they're true or not. It's just forcing the seller into facing the fact that he's got to do some research of his own so that he can give the appropriate representations and warranties. So this is, you know, it's telling the seller to be more careful, and it's better for the buyer because it's easier now for a buyer to enforce those reps and warranties. So that's good. There were often arguments under the old contract about when buyers and sellers, or mostly buyers, are doing diligence, who had to pay for and who was assuming risk. I think sometimes buyers would do some diligence and that they didn't like an answer they got, and they thought they'd been led down the garden path, they then would go back to sellers and go, hey, I did this and that, and I discovered, and you told me, and I've spent a bunch of money, and I want my money back. So now it's clear that if you do diligence, it's up to you. You take on the risk and you take on the cost. So no more getting stuff back from the seller. Brand new. If the buyer fails to pay a deposit by the agreed date, the seller may void the contract. Seller may void the contract. This came up because as much as buyers say, I'm going to make this initial deposit of $1,000 and I'm going to pay $10,000 more by way of a secondary deposit once I remove my conditions, buyers sometimes didn't pay the deposits. And it's a little known fact, you don't need to have a deposit to make a contract legal. Deposits are good faith money. Deposits are to show sellers that buyers have money, but they don't make the contract legal. And so buyers sometimes, I'm late. I don't want to pay that. And then sellers are going, hey, do I really have a deal here? And I took this guy's deal apart from the other four offers that were on the table because he said he was putting up the biggest deposit. So that's why he took his deal. Now he's not paying. So this is really to help the seller. Most of these clauses that we talk about are more are on the buyer side or the seller side, and this one is on the seller side so that there's now a spot in the contract that said buyer will pay his deposits by. If the buyer does not pay by the date, the seller can say, okay, contract's over. Give you a notice. There's an official notice. I am now voiding the contract because you didn't pay your deposit. And then the seller can deal with somebody else. That was from September 2016. In July 2017, they added this last one. Late deposit acceptance takes away the void option. So if I'm a buyer and I'm supposed to pay my deposit by today and I don't, and in 2 days I go, oh man, geez, I forgot about that deposit. I better get that in there. If the seller hasn't used his void option, I can still, even though it's after the date, pay my deposit. So that allows where it's really been an oversight, where the buyer and seller mean to complete the contract. It gives the buyer a chance to pay his deposit, not have the contract go out from under him. But the seller still, if by today he's just death on that deposit being paid, he still can do it. So it's given a bit more flexibility on the deposit side of things. The brand new contract kind of spruces up the ability of whoever is holding the deposit to return the deposit to the buyer once a contract is over. It says, I'm the buyer. My deal is conditional on financing. I don't get financing. I don't remove my condition by the date. According to the contract, the deal is over. If I don't remove my condition, the deal is over. And so I should get my deposit back. Seller says, you didn't even apply for financing, you SOB. I'm not giving you back that deposit. You have to. And the fight is on. So it's there so that deposits can be returned with a little more ease. Now, in the September 2016 contract, it said if the trustee, who's ever holding the money, usually a real estate office, sometimes a law office, somebody's holding the deposit, they're the trustee of the deposit monies. The 2016 contract said if the trustee gives the deposit back to whoever he thinks it should go back to, he has no liability. No liability for doing that. So that's gone from the 2017 version. So the trustee still has some liability. And I'm telling you what happens in these things. When I've held deposits and the buyers and sellers are going back and forth at each other, the contract doesn't close, the buyer wants his deposit back, the seller says the buyer didn't do stuff, and they're fighting with each other about who should have the deposit. So here I am, trustee, and they're both demanding that I give back the money. Or in the real estate office, the broker is being hounded to return the money to somebody. It was in the 2016, now it's gone. So trustees still have liability, and I predict that when people are fighting, it'll be just like it was before. It goes on for months and months and months, and sometimes people go to court. So I don't like this change. I think they should have stuck to the one that said, if the trustee gives it back, he doesn't have any liability. Buyers and sellers still have their rights to sue each other, do whatever they want. Just gums up the works. Encroachments. This is one of the warranties in Section 6. It says that the seller promises that there are no encroachments against the title. So encroachments are where the seller's property is over on the neighbor, like his garage is on the neighbor's property, or his front fence is on the city property. If you're over on the neighbor's property, that's a private encroachment. If you're onto city property or province property, that's a public encroachment. So this new section in the contract says that you can't have encroachments unless there is an encroachment agreement between the neighbors about the garage, and that often happens. Somebody discovers it, you talk to your neighbor, you say, geez, sorry, the contractor, I don't know, didn't build it the way it was supposed to. I know it's a foot on your property. Can we do something? So you reach agreement in a document called an encroachment agreement. You can register it against the title, and now everybody knows there's an encroachment. So that would be okay. And if it's a public one with municipalities, you can reach agreement with some municipalities about allowing encroachments. So now it just makes it clear who has to do what. If there's a public encroachment, so over your garage is encroaching on the back alley, most municipalities have an encroachment agreement application process. You call them up and they go, yes, here's our form, fill this out, send it in to us. If we're okay with it, we will send you back an encroachment agreement. So you just apply to the municipality. Sometimes they charge you money for it. I'm going to do a whole other tale from the trench on encroachments and how they can cost big whacks of money, but that's for another time. With the warranty that says the seller must have these kinds of agreements, when you get the real property report, it's the real property report that would show you the encroachments, because that's the, you know, the two-dimensional diagram of the property. So you look at that and you go, okay, the garage is onto the alleyway. And then you go, so where's the encroachment agreement with the city? So if I'm on for a buyer and I look at the RPR and I see the encroachment, the next thing I'm looking for is the agreement. If I don't see the agreement, I'm saying to the seller's lawyer, you have to get the agreement, and now we have to have a holdback. Talking about holdbacks, if there's no encroachment agreement, depends how big it is. If you're enclosing things, it's more. So that's how that gets dealt with. Okay? An easement is also an agreement between two parties to allow access by one party to another person's property. Typically, on the properties that we buy, the municipalities and the gas providers and the electrical guys have easements over our property so they can run their pipes and wires. So the contract says that generally buyers have to accept non-financial encumbrances like easements, as opposed to encroachments, which aren't supposed to be there. Restrictive covenants, that isn't new. It's in the old contract and the new contract, but that warranty says that sellers are responsible for the notion that everything under any registered restrictive covenant has been is in good order. Everything's being taken care of. And restrictive covenants show up on houses in new developments. This is a house where you have to have this kind of siding and these many trees and this kind of roof, this kind of square footage, and you can't park mobile homes. And so they can deal with a lot of stuff, but they're negative. They're saying you can't do things, or you have to do things. So restrictive covenants. I mean, I think the issue here is that as a seller, you're promising that everything under any registered restrictive covenant is going along according to what the restrictive covenant says. And if it isn't, then the buyer can sue you up to a couple of years after closing. So for example, I've got a client who's Had to foreclose on a 12-unit subdivision in northern Alberta, 12-lot subdivision, and there are four lots where houses have been built. The restrictive covenant says that they should be 2,500 square feet, there can't be any mobile homes, they have to be, you know, four bedrooms, three bathrooms. Quite a high-end property is demanded by the restrictive covenant. Not one of the four that's built is built according to the restrictive covenant. They're all 1,200 square feet. People have three or four mobile homes parked. Guys are selling cars. And so it is really, really, really giving my client a hard time where he wants to sell lots because everybody's going, gee, I was going to build a really nice house here. But look at these guys that are already built. So restrictive covenants are tricky. And if you buy without dealing with it, guess what? Sooner or later, you're going to sell. And some other sharper buyer will go, hey, I see that you're not complying with the restrictive covenant, and you have to. So be careful about restrictive covenants. It's not new, but I don't think anybody pays any attention to it. Disclosures and permits, brand new section. So the seller has to tell you whether he has got any notices from any government body about anything to do with the property, and he's got to tell you whether or not he knows about any permits that he should have obtained and hasn't. So this is beefed up from the old contract. Any notices from government and any permits that the seller should get that he knows about, he has to tell you. More on the buyer's side. More so that you, when you buy a piece of property, it's got all the permitting and paperwork that it's supposed to have. So I like this one. It does survive closing, and this one's good for the buyer. Dower. Dower is the notion that the old immigrant lady who pulled the plow on the quarter section for 40 years, plucked all the rocks out, and title was in her husband's name only, and then he ran off to Florida with a young floozy and sold the property out from under her, and she got nothing. Because that happened a whole bunch of times, the Dower Act says that if people are married, number one, and if either of them have ever lived on the property at any time since their marriage, the non-title spouse has to consent to the sale of the property. That's called dower consent. The old contract was kind of wishy-washy about it, said, you know, people should pay attention to that, and it was recommended that the non-title spouse provide dower consent. Now it's official. The non-title spouse has to provide it, and if they don't, the buyer can void the contract. Same concept as the deposits. Where deposits aren't paid when they're supposed to, buyer can void the contract. If the seller does not provide the appropriate dower consent in writing, buyer can void the contract. This should not be an issue, folks. Realtors deal with it when they list property. It should get dealt with, you know, when we do the contract, and it gets dealt with at closing. But now it's a much firmer requirement. And as a buyer, you're not going to be afraid, or you shouldn't be afraid, that some non-title spouse is going to jump out of the woods at the last moment and say, hey, I'm not signing anything. So this should all get done as part of your working up a house deal, and it should never bite you in the future. This one is kind of like the diligence condition that the buyer and seller will pay for their own diligence things. So if buyers and sellers have conditions on the property, you know, if you have a condition that says, I want to talk to EPCOR and get a bunch of research about where that pipeline is, and they make you pay a whole bunch of money to get old records out, well, you got to pay for that. So each party has to pay for costs related to their own condition. Brand new. It wasn't clear before. Now it's clear. Home inspection now have to be done by a licensed home inspector. Licensed home inspector. Home inspections and licensed home inspectors are pretty new here in Alberta. 3 years, maybe? Used to be that you could just call your brother-in-law or your grandpa, the ex-carpenter, or somebody could be your inspector. Now it has to be a licensed inspector, and you can't use the inspector to get a quote on what the fix-ups might be that are required to put the property in the condition that you need it. That's a conflict of interest. Inspectors are supposed to be inspectors and not be tradespeople giving you quotes. So no more getting that from the inspector. Miscellaneous changes. There used to be a section called It was called final signing. It was right at the end of the contract. Said the party who last signed the contract was buyer or seller on such and such a date. So it was just kind of sitting there. And the analysis by the area people and realtors and lawyers is that has nothing to do with contract law. Contracts are offer and acceptance. I offer to buy your property. We dicker back and forth. You accept my offer sooner or later. It's offer, acceptance, contract is done. You don't have to talk about who last signed it. It adds nothing to the conversation. It was an extra piece of verbiage that didn't really mean anything, so it's out. Email acceptance. The last contract, the 2014 contract, said contracts could be sent back and forth either personally, I can deliver it to you, or I can fax it over to Dell. But now it officially says you can send them also by email. So I think we were all doing it anyway, and people every once in a while would go, oh, hold on here. How did I get that? I got that by email. That's not official. Almost everything goes by email, right? We have a brand new phone system in our office. I bet we spent, I don't know, thousands and thousands of dollars on our new phone system because it wasn't quite integrating with our network. I bet I get two calls a week. I have lots of work. My inbox is like, I deal with 60 to 100 emails every day. But calls, not happening. Everything happens by email. Yes, we didn't like that expenditure. That wasn't very good. All right, what's next? Notice of rejection. This is a good one. So in the old contract, there was nothing and no way to say that you weren't going to go ahead with the deal. So you write a contract. You give yourself 2 weeks for financing and inspections. And during that 2 weeks, you go, oh, my God, my realtor just came up with the perfect house, the dream house, the one I've been looking for. This one looked good till I saw the dream house. We're buying the dream house. So that's 3 days into the two-week condition period. So you as a buyer know that you're not going to buy. So now you have the ability to say to the seller, I'm not buying, and finish it off, and the seller can now go on and deal with his property and sell it to somebody else, and you can move on to the other one, instead of waiting for the condition period to expire. Now, you didn't actually have to do that, but what this has done is it's given people a mechanism to finish a contract and move on where they know for sure they're not going to go ahead with it. So I like that change. That's good. This is probably good for buyers and sellers. Kind of keeps things cleaned up and moves it all along. There used to be a property inspection schedule that you could use. If you're a buyer and you wanted to get your property inspected, how did it used to be? Buyers read a condition in, subject to inspection satisfactory to buyer. That's just written in as a condition, 2 weeks away. Buyer changes his mind, says to his realtor, you know what? There's that chip in the drywall in the downstairs bathroom. You know that one that's behind the furnace that you have to, you know, you really can't get to it very easily, but I saw a chip on that drywall and I don't like it. So, gall darn it, I'm not buying that house. So, realtors developed a property inspection schedule that said, this is subject to a property inspection. Buyer will get an official inspector to do it. Buyer agrees that the deficiencies that the inspector might discover have to exceed a dollar figure or exceed a percentage of the value of the property, or it isn't a reason that the buyer can reject the contract. It also said that if the buyer rejected the deal because of the property inspection, he had to give the seller a copy of his property inspection report. So what happened with all of that? So they were trying to deal with a circumstance where buyers were being silly and using the contract to their advantage and rejecting contracts for no good reason. So the property inspection schedule is trying to put a rope around that and make it more objective. So the buyer gets his inspection, and he goes, I really don't want to buy that house, but I'm now limited by the clause that says you know, the cost of the deficiency fix-ups have to exceed $2,500. So he's out going, hello, high-priced gold-plated tradesman. I need a quote. Oh, $5,000? You're my man. Let's have that. So he gets a quote for $5,000, sends it back to the seller, says, geez, sorry, I can't close. It's going to take $5,000, and, you know, my limit's $25,000, so I don't know. If you want to help me out on that, you could reduce the price, I guess. The property schedule wasn't working the way it was supposed to work. Buyers and sellers were both taking it and manipulating it to allow themselves out of a contract when they just didn't want to be in it. And when buyers were saying to inspectors, I need another copy of that inspection report because I have to give it to the seller, the inspectors are going, well, hold on here. I did this report for you. According to my insurance and my organization, you can't give it to anybody. So now we have a collision between what the property schedule requires the buyer to do and what he can actually do with his report. So the property inspection schedule is out, which doesn't mean that you can't construct your own to fit your circumstances. You just have to be careful that you don't get yourself back into some of these contortions that the old property schedule led to. So that one's gone. That was interesting that it's gone from one, one part of the spectrum to the other, a real pendulum swing there. Condominiums, got a little bit on condominiums. So condominium property can be the unit that you live in. It can be a parking unit. The unit that you live in or somebody lives in, that has a title. Parking units can have titles. Storage lockers or storage spaces can have titles. Parking spaces can be assigned or they can be exclusive use, which are two different things, as can storage lockers. So the new contract makes all of those different possibilities for what you're buying in a condo, it makes it a whole bunch clearer, whole bunch clearer. In condos, everybody's pretty sure about the living unit side of it. But when it gets on to the parking units and the storage units, it's all over the landscape. I can't tell you how many times people go, so where's that second parking title of mine? Where's my storage space? I'm going, it's not written in the contract. How do I know? Anyway, the new contract makes it a whole bunch easier to describe what in fact you're actually getting as a buyer. So it makes you think about it a little bit more. It makes it more accurate for you. Condominium documents. Sellers are supposed to supply condominium documents to buyers. The new contract says, seller will supply condominium documents by such and such a time. And then it says, if seller doesn't supply by such and such a time, buyer has an extra fill in the blank 3-4 days to get those documents on its own. So that's an add-on. If the seller doesn't do it, you can do it. And this is very, very, very important on the condominium side of things. Success in condominium buying is getting those condominium documents, especially the financial statements and the reserve fund studies and reserve fund plans and reserve fund reports, and reading those or get them read by somebody who knows what they're doing and analyzing the hell out of them so that you don't get caught by some giant special assessment. So condominium documents are really, really important. The new contract allows a buyer to, if he gets them because the seller won't, the buyer can have the price adjusted so that the cost of the condominium documents is taken off the price. And they can be pricey. You know, I've seen them as much as $250. So if you have to do them as buyer, you can deduct that from the price, but it also gives you the right to sue the seller after the fact. Kind of a holler remedy. You're going to sue a seller for $250. I mean, normally it's $125 or something. But nevertheless, it's a change in the contract. The big one here, though, is with respect to condominium fees and contributions and special assessments. The old contract said that the seller is responsible for all special assessments, the seller is responsible for all special assessments approved by board resolution prior to the closing date. That's good. I mean, as a buyer, you want to know that if the seller knew that there was a $40,000 special assessment and it was all approved by the board a month ago, that he's going to pay for that and you don't have to take the heat on closing. Here's the change, and you really got to watch out for this one. This might be the biggest one. It says that the seller is responsible for all special assessments approved by board resolution and, wait for it, this is so exciting. Isn't it exciting? You can hardly wait. All special assessments approved by the board and levied prior to the closing date. Levied. It's fine to say by resolution, well, you know, I guess we're going to have to bite the bullet and spend the damn $40,000 per unit. Great. But you actually, as a board, have to send the notice out to all the unit owners saying, yeah, well, we got to do it. We're now levying the condo fee. So that's a change. So you be very careful when you're buying to make sure that those special assessments are not going to fall on your shoulders. So you have to get some coaching on that. So that's a little one on special assessments that you got to really, really, really watch out for. So in conclusion, you know, after all this chitting and chatting, the 2016-17 version is, I think, a way better contract. It clarifies a whole bunch of things. It makes things way more specific. It puts more obligation on each party to do their own thing. But it's got some of these tricky little things in it, like the condominium assessments that we were just talking about. So, I mean, it reads better. It's got more space. They've taken some stuff out of it at the back. There was a whole bunch of stuff about representatives and just took up a bunch of space. So it reads better. It looks better. And overall, I think, you know, the emphasis is that it's making the due diligence side of things for buyers and sellers on the shoulders of each party. You do good, solid diligence, whether you're buyer or seller, and you pay for it, and then you will have a much happier buying or selling experience. So overall, it's a way better contract.
Thanks for listening to Barry Maguire's Tales from the Trenches. Get the inside scoop on real estate investing from one of Canada's foremost real estate lawyers. To print this tale and for more valuable investing insights, go to www.barrymaguire.ca.